Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 21st, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon, we have Michael Schutt. Today he is continuing his series, Simpler Living, Compassionate Life, Caring for Creation from a Christian Perspective. Today's title is The Good Life and the Abundant Life. Today's session number is SCM 2003. Let's listen in.
In the Greek.
Pretty sweet, huh? Yeah, in the Greek. Oh, feels good. So I'd recommend that. In fact, if you want to go right now, it's pretty... I'd understand. My name is Mike Scott, and I work with Earth Ministry in Seattle. There's a bunch of, well, some Earth Ministry materials over here, and you can get on our mailing list if you'd like to. We work with churches ecumenically on the connections between faith and caring for creation. And who hasn't been to any of these sessions yet this week? Okay. Good number. All right. Well, I'll give a brief summary of where we've been, and then move on to today's topic of the abundant life and the good life. Why don't we just have a little bit of silence first to quiet ourselves, and then we'll begin. Amen. So the title of all these sessions generally has been Simpler Living, Compassionate Life, and partly it comes, a lot of what we've been talking about comes out of this book called Simpler Living, Compassionate Life. And the bookstore is sold out. If you want a copy, I have one left. And otherwise you can let me know and I can send you one from, get you one from Earth Ministry. And the first session we talked a bit about simpler living, what it is and what it isn't, how it's not only a path of individual change, not only a path emphasizing personal growth, and not primarily a list of do's and don'ts, but that it is, it does involve addressing our consumptive habits. It will involve developing communities of support, because the moving towards simpler living is often swimming against the dominant cultural messages. And then talked about, that's the simpler living portion of it, of the title, and then compassionate life being compassion including both empathy and justice. We talked a little about how compassion sometimes is only seen as empathy, but that in Frederick Buechner's definition, it also includes justice. Buechner says that compassion is that sometimes fatal capacity for feeling what it's like to live inside another's skin. So there's empathy, knowing that there could never really be peace and joy for any until there is peace and joy finally for all. So there's the element of sort of all-encompassing justice. And thus, this book has a strong emphasis on justice, and both sort of typically called environmental and social justice, but maybe we could say earth justice in general. And the second day, and we started to get into what that might mean a little bit, and some people have asked, you know, why don't we talk about some real practical applications of this stuff, and we could do that perhaps even in tomorrow's session, sort of practical resources you could use in your own lives to make steps that would express some of these changes. But the second day, we spent some time on talking about the human economy and the global economy, and how a big problem with our human economy, and in a sense, we're forced to, in this world, to make choices. I was talking with Dave of his church in northeastern Oregon is involved in very difficult issues around water rights. And there's people on all sides of the issue, government and environmental groups and farmers. And how do farmers who are Christian farm justly when in some ways they're forced by a system to not act justly. And by that, we were talking about hiring migrant workers, of taking most of the water out of the Walla Walla at times it runs dry, but that may be natural causes, they're not sure. But this economic system that does not see the universe and ourselves as sacred forces us in some ways to live in a compromised state. So we talked about externalities within the human economy. The externalities are the waste of the human economy and the impacts, obviously, that the externalities have on the earth and on, and when I say earth, of course, I'm including people within that, just to remind you of that. And when I say community, I mean to include non-human community in that definition too. And then Wednesday morning, we took about 17 of us went and took a contemplative hike, walk. I read a story and then a few prayers, and we walked in silence from here to the falls and then back a little ways in silence, and just talked about that experience. And in some ways how in our busyness and in our drivenness, we fill our hands with many things and ignore the state of our hearts at times. And so there was that connection in some ways between a contemplative experience and the simpler living, the economic justice, and so on that we've been talked about in the earlier sessions. And today, well, is there any comments on that or questions? And that some of you who've been here want to say something else, for those of you who are new, that would help summarize or comments? Okay.
I should think of getting back to a lot of basic wishes instead of all things that are in the world.
So that's something you've been picking up on, you mean?
Yeah, I just think the heights we had and the things you've been talking about.
Well, yeah, that reminds me of simpler living is not necessarily simple or easy. I mean, and how maybe one guy came up to me and said later, I wonder if what you're talking about is sustainability. And I think I do kind of use those interchangeably, but partly I've wanted to expand the definition of what people think of when they hear the word simpler living. That it's not primarily, you know, a path to personal growth and for those who already have enough or more than enough to sort of have more of what they feel they're lacking. But, I mean, and that's a fine place to start. But to move from there to these larger questions of justice, and that without justice, there won't be sustainability, without greater equity in the world. But that doing that will not be simple. And so some people might think it's a misleading word to use here. But I also gave the analogy of how ecosystems are very complex. And they're complex in that there's a complex web of interdependent relationships going on in the natural world. And in a sense, moving towards simpler living, it seems to me, is partly about reconnecting what are severed relationships, and thus increasing our dependency on one another, and our awareness of our dependency on the earth and on each other and on God. So today, how many of you have attended Dale's sessions, Dale Jomgaard? Anyone want to? Okay, so a few folks have heard his discussions around sin and self-justification. And I take a risk here in trying to summarize something I don't know much about. So if some of the rest of you want to, if I've missed something, please throw that in. But I felt like it's real, it fits in real well with moving on to talking about the idolatry of the good life and the abundant life that Jesus invited us to and invites us to. So, Dale talked about how we often reduce our sense of sin what sin is to acts, to simple behaviors, and how being forgiven from a certain act, sure, that's a good thing and one to be celebrated, but the depth of release and celebration and joy that comes from that is not nearly what is indicated in, I believe it's in Paul's, you know, we are enslaved to sin. And that suggests a much deeper sort of boundedness. And he would suggest that what it is that's at the root of much of our sin is this drive to justify ourselves, as opposed to being, we all have this phrase, you know, we're justified by grace, you know, a good deal, but how does it really hit us at a deep level? He would suggest it hits us when we realize the level to which we're enslaved to this drive to justify ourselves. And in the temptations that Jesus faced, he talked about that, and how those temptations can be seen. You know, first Satan says, if you are the Son of God, and Gail points out how that immediately, the word if, raises the question, where we begin, and in this case Jesus began, to question his self-worth or his identity. If you are the Son of God, then do these things. If, Jeff, if you are worthwhile, then you have to be a caring pastor. And then he's going to live up to that, maybe. And he's sort of, as opposed to being a pastor, simply by the grace of God, and because he's called to offer his gifts that way. So, you know, if you're the Son of God, turn these stones into bread. How that's not a sin in and of itself, to turn stones into bread. I mean, Jesus, before this, I mean, fed all these people, you know, turned 6 loaves and 5 fishes or whatever into feeding 5,000. So it wasn't the actual act, it was the motivation behind it. So Dale was suggesting, if you are the Son of God, prove it by your abilities, by your abilities. The other one, the next one, prove it by the response you can get from other people. 3, prove it by your possessions. So when you know who you are, or you prove you're somebody in these ways, by your abilities, by the response you can get from other people, and by your possessions or positions of power, that one being, you know, bow down to me and I will give you all the kingdoms of the earth, all the power and possessions that would have given Jesus. So, and Dale suggests that all three of these are these efforts at self-justification that we are all tempted by and in a way deeply enslaved to. And to be free from that, I mean, then that is like, you know, go out of here jumping and singing, as opposed to, oh yeah, you know, I was forgiven again, or it just really hit me at a deep level, and I found it very helpful to think about. And then we become anxious people, afraid we're not enough, and so we continue to prove ourselves. I mean, one example for me would be if I get a positive response from you all, from teaching or being here this week, and I somehow think that that's what makes me worthwhile, and I think I've got to find a job that allows me to continue to do this so I can sort of still have this identity as a teacher, let's say. And in a way, I have a real opportunity, because this job will end for me soon, and I don't know what's next. So I have a real opportunity to face these things more openly. And if there's an opportunity where some of my gifts continue to be expressed this way, great. But it's not like it's not something I have to prove who I am by. So it's a great freedom, I think. And then he says the self we must die to in this way of living is the self we've created in order for the self that God created to blossom. And it could be the very same person. I mean, I could have a job just like this come November when my other job ends. But I hope I would always be bringing to it an open-handed approach to it, being willing to lose it, but also being willing to offer it, I guess. So it seems like a very, in some ways, very subtle and almost insidious thing, but a great freedom. And as I've just finished up, Dale has come in the room. That's pretty funny. Oh, yeah. No, I don't.
Now you don't have to worry about it if you got it right.
I literally just finished summarizing. Oh, gosh. So, we are who we are by the grace of God. And I thought in our discussion of the abundant life and the good life to have our ears open to this urge for us to self-justify, because it seems quite related to many of the idols, implicit or explicit, within our dogged pursuit of the good life. So, Dale, if you had been here, you could say, well, that was really, you know, you missed it on this point. But some of the others of you who have heard Dale maybe want to chime in, and if there's something that's missing or unclear.
I thought you did it fine.
You're all right.
Yep, you were right there.
We're all right?
Yep.
And even if you weren't, we'd love you.
Oh, yeah. Thank God. So I did okay.
We don't justify ourselves by being right, getting it right.
No, but I feel better now since I'm doing that. So, oh, one thing I think it's interesting in this story, how the tempter in the story, you know, if you are the Son of God and so on, sort of immediately goes for the jugular of prove who you are, you know, self-justify yourself. Smart fellow. So then I thought we would move on to this good life, abundant life discussion, because when I was, again, this book is a collection of over 30 essays by 21 different authors on issues of time, money, global economics, the history of simplicity within the Christian tradition, food choices and their connections to social and environmental justice, theology and worldview, community. So I'm like, in the epilogue and in the introduction, I was like, how do you sort of introduce and wrap up such a motley group of topics? But in the introduction, it seemed to me a helpful way to think about it would be to think about, you know, we all know the good life because it's marketed all around us. The model might be, as Bill McKibben said, you know, when he watched all the cable TV that came across one channel in a day, and he spent a whole year watching all those channels, and he said the main message is, if you boil it down to one thing, you are the heaviest known object in the universe. The world revolves around you as an individual. That's, in a sense, the good life, is this me-centered pursuit of affluence and prestige and status that we get all around us. And then there's this, Christians at least have this image of the abundant life. I have come, you might have life and have it abundantly. And so so the introduction tries to help people think about this good life and its pursuit and the abundant life, and how those might compare and contrast as a way to kind of hold together some of the thoughts throughout the book. So I thought, yeah, in some ways, and in that introduction, I talk a bit about how the good life is one of our more powerful idols. And again, an idol promises something that it cannot finally deliver. I think I talked about that Monday, and how Roger Walsh's author said the only problem with substitute gratifications is that you cannot get enough of what you do not need. You cannot get enough of something you do not really need. And so he said it more eloquently, but essentially that is another definition, in the sense of an idol, and why it never is satisfying. It does not deliver that which it promises. And I think those of us who, in some ways, have achieved society's definition of the good life know that that's not final peace and well-being. But also to recognize that an idol is a lesser good, elevated to the ultimate good, but to recognize that there are some goods, some lesser goods within an idol, and thus not to just sort of set up a straw man and dismiss this straw man of the good life, because it does do some things that are good, and thus it is powerful and difficult sometimes to distinguish between the good life and the abundant life. And I thought I would just read a couple of examples of how I think that's the case. For example, the good life would enable us to meet basic human material needs and promises that ability, which would seems to me to be a characteristic of abundance. But the good life does so for only a few at the expense of the many, which would not be a characteristic of the abundant life that Jesus promised. But again, I think there's some mimicry going on. Second, the good life promises a certain level of happiness, right? And that might in some ways mimic the abundant life's promise of deep joy. Finally, there's also the good life promises the ability to care for all those in our community, those we love, our families and friends, let's say, which would seem to be a characteristic of abundance. But it seems like in the good life's definition of community, it's a very narrow definition of community, particularly in the context of this book, the rest of the earth, the rest of the non-human community, is often left out of that definition, those with whom we are called to share the goodness or the abundance that we have. So I just think that's important to recognize that within all of our idols, and one of the reasons idols are difficult to deal with is that there's some good within them, but that when they sort of replace God in any ultimate way, they become an idol. And I think the good life is one of our culture's more powerful one. And within that, talk about other idolatries of the good life, like economic growth, productivity, materialism, and so on. And if you have any comments or questions, just feel free to interrupt any time. Yeah.
Reed, you mean the definition of the good life, but the world centers around me? Is that what your definition was?
The good life as defined by our culture would be that which you get when you open a magazine and look at a slick ad, when you turn on the TV and you see the rich and the famous. I don't have a specific definition, but it seems kind of there's an understood what it is we're striving for in American culture anyway. And my example was Bill McKibben wrote this book on watched television for a year, all the channels that came across, the largest cable network in the world. And he said the message, if you had to boil it down to one message, would be that one, that you as an individual are the heaviest known object in the universe, that the world revolves around you. So this real reduction and individualistic focus. Jeff, and then
another word that comes to mind is myth. I think that the good life is a cultural myth, and myths, the problem with myths is that they contain some truth.
Okay, yeah.
But
or like an idol has a lesser good within it.
Yeah. Often myth gets used to mean not true.
Right.
Which isn't accurate.
Right.
Myths have some truth in them. And sometimes that truth is very important. Like the creation myths in Genesis, the truth that's in those is very important for us to have.
Right. Okay, thanks. And do you think some of the things that I pointed out are some of the myths, true myths of the good life?
Some of the things that mimic what the abundant life is about, the things about having you'll have what you need. Mm-hmm. Well, except that I'll have what I need, not everybody having what they need.
Yeah.
So there are some of the parts of the truth that are there.
Thanks. Yeah. Did you have something?
Well, I was just going to say that just listening to you, it seems like the good life is also the way that the media is defining success. So it's a very narcissistic view of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
Ultimately, to me, the good life is what you don't have, what you wish to have. Mm-hmm. Like when you see those advertisements for cars, they're bigger, you know? I mean, that's the good life they're showing.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it's one of its insidious, one of the things that's insidious about it is that once you get it, you think there's something else you need still.
Yeah.
Well, on a personal level, I know that as I move up in income, I think I've done really well, but then I realize all the more that I can have, and then I make that jump, and I think, great, I'm there, and then all of a sudden there's all the more, and it's endless. Right.
Yeah, if what you're chasing is more.
Right.
I think the good life is what I want, but it's not what I need. I don't need all that. What I think is what I want to make a good life.
I'd like to illustrate about 3 points. We have cushions abundantly down here.
Yeah.
If I was to say, see what we have down here, tough luck. But if I was to throw it up to you so you could use it and beat my chest for being a good guy, then I would be under Dale's category of self.
Justified.
But if I would have slipped it up there quietly early in the session, it would have been an act of kindness.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And do you have like a wallet you're wanting to do something with as well now? Sort of continue the analogy.
We don't know about my wallet, that's it.
I didn't get the cushion.
Credit card, yeah. $1 bill, and a rubber band.
You're ready for ice cream later.
And I get an allowance from my wife monthly, and I'm now next December.
So, as I, in a way, this week we've, in the first couple sessions, like Monday and Tuesday particularly, talked about larger global issues. I mean, obviously Tuesday, global economics, but also on Monday, sort of what simpler living is and isn't, kind of a macro view, and this sense of justice, which obviously encompasses the whole earth. So today, in this context of the good life and the abundant life, and also what is maybe most immediate to all of us is our relationship with time and money, if we have time to get there. In many ways, that's what draws families or individuals to what they think simplicity might be about first, is a sense of being out of control of their time, too busy, rushing around, or their relationship with money. Either they're really in debt and struggling with it, or they realize it's a very powerful idol for them and they'd like to move to greater freedom. A variety of sort of lack of peace inside about our relationships with these with time and money. And that's what the first two sections of the book actually address. The hope is that those who are drawn for those reasons are also then begin to make connections between those things and these larger global issues that we've been talking about earlier this week. So I thought we would move on to talk a bit about time. And the section in the book is called Time as Commodity, Time as Sacred. You know, we do have that phrase, time equals money. And On Tuesday, I talked about how our economic system finally asks us to see everything as resource. People, the land, and so on. Finally, everything's a resource when push comes to shove. Communities are resources, labor capital and resources go into that, the line of our global economy, and at the other end, you get a bunch of stuff. So, and that's another way of saying that everything is commodified in the global economy, and finally, we've even commodified time. To time equals money. And the New Roadmap Foundation, have any of you read the book, Your Money or Your Life? Okay, I'd recommend, it's in my handout that I had on all those resources you can use. I've listed that book, and it's also in the bibliography here. Your Money or Your Life, put out by the New Roadmap Foundation. And they actually have a 6-week study guide for Christians as well, if you're interested in doing a small group around that. But they have helpfully, in a way, said, what is time, but in a sense, the gift of your life? It's sort of like you're given this gift of a life. That's what you have, and it's all a gift. And in a sense, by saying time equals money, we're saying that all you've been given as a gift is money, ultimately. What is that, the transitive property in math or something? But so anyway, the ultimate commodification of life in the sense that time itself is money. As opposed to this sense of time as sacred and as a gift of life energy. It's a gift of life energy. If moving toward abundance is something as Christians toward the abundant life is something as Christians we would recognize would be a good thing. And particularly in relationship with time, if we would want to move toward a greater sense of time as sacred, the question is, what is it that keeps us from that? And from moving in a sense from these idols of productivity and efficiency to life as a gift and all of our life energy sense as a gift. Do you have any comments on that before I answer my own question?
Yeah, I do. In Dan and Karen's session this morning, on Jewish life, was also on time this morning, and they were quoting Rabbi Abraham Heschel, who wrote before the Sabbath.
Oh, yeah.
And Heschel says, we think we live in a world, and this is your words, not his, but it's not, you know, space, and that's all around us manipulated, and time is the limited commodity. And therefore, we make it into a commodity productivity issue. He says, from a Jewish perspective, it's the opposite. Time, as sacred as gift, is the abundance. And it is a debt that doesn't have a bottom to it. It is the unlimited commodity, depending on how we use it in our lives. Mm. And Sabbath, in a sense, is made to demonstrate that if you embrace time differently, by not using it productively, that life still works and it works better. You know, but I'm not saying this very well. But
no, it makes sense, yeah.
And it's an attempt to reverse the sense of time is not a limited commodity, time is not money.
Well, it's interesting. Stacy, another teacher here this week, she told a story of a Tanzanian guy that she met who had come here. And she said in his culture, he said that time to him had always been like sand. Sand on the beaches of the world, like there's no way you'd even think of counting it. And he said, I'm realizing how you folks think of time is like goats. And they count their goats all the time in Tanzania because it's like what you give for your, you know, to get a bride or, you know, the bridal price and so on.
That's how you measure wealth.
Yeah, and so he said that you folks are looking at time like goats as opposed to sand. You know, this interesting, it's very similar to what you're saying. And when I, you know, again, as one of the idols of the sub-idols, let's say, of the good life being productivity in relationship to time, again, not meaning to say, you know, there's no good within productivity. We all like to feel productive, or feel like, in a sense, maybe the good within that is offering our gifts back to the community. But if all that we have is sort of this rush to continually be productive, it seems to me the danger within that is that God's voice, or this our own inner voice, we risk the losing the ability to hear that. And that seems like a real danger within this continual striving to be efficient and productive all the time. And while we might all acknowledge that, we also all, well, I don't know about all, I find it difficult to slow down. I just joined a church community modeled after Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C., and one of the things we have committed to together is an hour a day in prayer, journaling, reading, you know, some kind of discipline together. And we kind of try and let each other know how that's going. And the hardest thing for me to do, I mean, I'll play guitar a little while, or maybe read a little bit, and pray for people or myself or whatever. But then I would really like to do this, you know, centering prayer thing. And when I try and do centering prayer, I'm just everywhere, you know, my mind is everywhere. And I think Gerald May has a real helpful suggestion as to why it's maybe particularly difficult in some ways to face real stillness, or because, well, let me just go on to read what May has to say about slowing down. And it's in a chapter in the book called Entering the Emptiness. And it's in a section on the myth of fulfillment, saying that's a myth in our culture as well, that we will someday be fulfilled, fully fulfilled. So, we make several great mistakes, he says, if we think life should or even can be resolved to a point of complete serenity and fulfillment. To believe this is to commit ourselves to a fantasy that does not exist, and that if it were true, would finally kill our love. It is also to remove our concern from the real issues of our life and world, to transfer our energy to a vague, self-serving agenda that must be carried out before we can get on with the business of loving and living and creating a better world. Further, the myth perpetuates, I really like this, the myth perpetuates the willful delusion that we human beings are objects, like machines, to be built and repaired, meant for efficiency rather than love. So again, that really relates to this, you know, idol of productivity and efficiency. And it's interesting too that he's saying the myth perpetuates that human beings are objects like machines. Again, that the global economy does not recognize the sacredness of all life. Instead, it views even humans as objects for that production line, machines to produce for the production line. So there's some neat connections made there. But most importantly, May says, the myth of fulfillment makes us miss the most beautiful aspect of our human souls. He says it's our emptiness, our incompleteness, our radical yearning for love. We were never meant to be completely fulfilled. We were meant to taste it, to long for it, and to grow toward it. In this way, we participate in love becoming life, and in life becoming love. So May says to miss our emptiness is finally to miss our greatest hope, because it is that which keeps us yearning and desiring after God. But also, he acknowledges that facing emptiness, which I think sometimes I've experienced now and then in silence or in that sort of centering prayer space, that emptiness is awfully scary. In a sense, it's a place where these self-justifications are no longer. So that's one of the reasons that I've felt this movement toward time as sacred, and moving from time as productivity and efficiency and all that is difficult, and why it's often difficult for humans to settle into a different experience of time, partly because we might be exposed to our own emptiness. And if you open to comments on that, or
I completely relate to that and believe that to some extent. For most of my life, I've always said, if only I met the right woman, you know, then my life would be better. And if only I had enough time, and if only I had enough money, those were sort of the three things. And then I would do great things. And then it's like, I feel like God almost played a trick on me when he put a check mark in all those categories, have all of those. And then it's a humbling proposition now. What do I do? You know, I don't have to do anything. And I thought I would do wondrous things, and now I'm finding that I'm a lot simpler and more afraid of a human being than I ever thought I was. Mm-hmm. When I could kind of sit, face life from a disempowered place to say, well, I have to do all these things. I have to work, I have to eat, you know, search. So the productivity is a great distraction, you know.
I'm reminded of the effect of the so-called Protestant work ethic on my own development as a person, and how I think on the one hand it functioned to bring a lot of people out of poverty. That commitment that we're told we got from the Reformation period onward. Both Calvinism and Lutheranism, I think, were heavily committed to that work ethic. But I'm also thinking of how, when I was a child, I was told in many ways, primarily by my parents, what a sin it is to waste time, which meant not using time to produce something,
right?
To generate income, to generate wealth. It was mostly in a farming economy, but you wasted time when you weren't out in the field doing what needed to be done. And a waste of time was viewed as a pretty profound sin, a wrong thing to do. And I think that's in conflict with the approach to time that you're talking about. Where time can be used also for non-productive, non-market,
right,
motivation.
Something outside that line of the
global
economy.
Something outside the market, yeah.
I think, too, that there can also be a very sacred view of time within the context of efficiency and working. For example, in the Shaker tradition of hands to work and hearts to God, where your time, there is a goal to be working, and there are beautiful things that are produced, but working is seen as a contemplative act, and it's very different than, it's not a question of how much you produce or what profit, it's working as something beautiful, as gift.
That's so. Right, thanks for that example. Dave, and then?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm always 2 seconds behind, so again, this morning with Dan and Kathy, it takes me a while to process things, but it's a two things that I thought were very interesting. One was, the sacredness of time, as observed in Sabbath, in no way depreciates work, or even Protestant work ethic. I think that would be balanced. Because they say the opening prayers of Sabbath and the closing prayers of Sabbath both include thanksgiving for work, so that we can be productive and that we can defend things, but with the recognition that Sabbath is primary, so we don't do it now. You know, and so I think part of the issue for those of us with a Protestant work ethic is we have a balance. And no rooting other than in that.
Right.
And so the struggle is always one. So that's interesting to see how the Jews do that. And the other thing they said was the primacy of keeping Sabbath sacred.
Yeah.
That happened in two ways. One was they said, as any Jewish guy, Orthodox, liberal, whenever Jews say, how do I feel more Jewish again, the first thing they always say is, observe Sabbath. I mean, that's across the spectrum.
That's starting point.
Mm-hmm. If you want to get back in your Jewishness, start to observe Sabbath. And along with that, they were saying, couple days ago, they did Yom Kippur, which is the highest Jewish holiday, and they were talking about how they blow the shofar, the horn, and it just hits the heart of every Jew when they do that. They said, but if Yom Kippur falls on Sabbath, you don't blow the shofar because it's work. And the primacy of the sacred time, of the Sabbath day, overtakes even the highest Jewish holidays and its traditions. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is, I'm struck by the way that the balance happens in the recognition of the sacredness of time.
Thanks. And then, Susan, did you have something too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Okay, I just know that as a high school student, there are so many options open to me, and I always found myself wanting to get involved in everything. And there have been times during the school year or during my life when all of a sudden I've had so much going on that I all of a sudden don't want to do anything. And that those things that are such gifts, opportunities, things to explore that I love doing, I don't get any enjoyment out of them. And that if you don't take time to rest, if you don't take time to reflect and realize why the gifts they are to you, then they become kind of meaningless.
Yeah. Thanks. Dale?
I think you tied a couple of things together that I think were very significant. You talked about what happens when you really are meditating or going to yourself. And you said it gets almost scary. Dr. Schmitz at Luther, when I went there, said we don't have an English word for it. The Germans have a word called angst. Angst is a deep, unnameable anxiety that is deep within us. And it is, I think, in the language I would use, is the fear of being nobody. And so when we stop and really go in, we get close to the angst.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need to start getting away from it. And we can either get away by our own efforts, proving our own worth, or we can die with Christ at that point and receive grace and be free from the angst in the message, you are a child of God by God's grace. So I think what happens in a culture is we begin to define the ways of proving our worth. And you also pointed out that they don't satisfy. We kind of just barely get there, and then it's not enough, that we have to do more. And I think we're in a culture now where we're just going to have to, we're doing more and more and more. People are busier than ever. Our work life is demanding more and more, even when both mother and father work. Imagine how much more time goes into the productive work of society, the money-earning work, than did a few generations ago when only one person in a family worked, and that was enough. And so we're on a treadmill, and where that's going to take us, I think, is all of the question.
Yeah.
I'd like to make one comment on Dale's comment, and that is that both persons work, but one by one salary.
That's right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I tried to say productive, money making.
Remunerative.
Remunerative.
As recognized within that line of the global economy.
There's one more aspect of that, just real quickly, is it's a little bit of an Anglo thing, because when I lived in Mexico, they're much slower. They're slower culture.
Hawaii's is different.
Slower.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to money. I mean, shoot.
Well, we have time.
Oh, shoot, we have 5 minutes or so. But time is money, so we've already talked about it.
So.
But I think it was Larry Rasmussen earlier this week at some setting said, you know, we now in churches can even talk about sex, but we cannot talk about money still. And
about our personal.
Our personal
sexuality we can talk about, but not our personal finances, our how much we make and all of that.
Yeah.
except if we're talking about how much a pastor's gonna make.
Well, that's
okay.
That's our
personal experience.
I wanted to make sure.
One of the things the community that I'm in is doing, besides this other thing I told you about the commitment to an hour a day, is an agreement that we will tithe to the community, and then the community will decide together what to do with that money. And it's agreed that we'll give 10%, and we'll talk about more or see how we go with that for a while. But, you know, the idea is that let's just start there. And in a way, I used to give 10% when I was younger, and then I came out of Wheaton College very angry, and I just couldn't do much at all with the church. So for a long time, I didn't, you know, tithe. I mean, I'd give some here and there, and then the last few years, it's something I've wanted. I've wanted to, like, have that be, in a sense, what William Stringfellow says is the best image for Christians in their use of money, and that is as a sacrament. Money as a sacrament. I've kind of wanted to get back to at least sort of this is a symbol of what I would like to be like, as a little more generous than I have been or something. So, but I wasn't doing it still. And so in a way, this community has helped me make that step and just do it now every month. But obviously in our culture, money is, as Stringfellow says, one of maybe our in the pantheon of idols, the most powerful idol that we have. And I wanted to, well, another thing that might be helpful to you, I mean, hopefully some of what these ideas will be something you could take with you and talk with others about, maybe even here the next week you're here or whatever, but one idea around getting in touch with your relationship with money is, and this is another idea that Church of the Savior had us do sometimes back in D.C., is write your money autobiography. And how is it you grew up with money? You know, is your relationship with money now more like your mom's or your dad's? Or do you have a sense of abundance or scarcity? For myself, I grew up, my folks didn't make a lot of money. So I grew up with a sense of scarcity, and I saved everything, and it's still quite hard, although I'm much freer, to spend money on myself, for example. But it's also difficult to trust that all have enough. And so yet also having experienced how other cultures live, have this tension of knowing I am incredibly wealthy. Mm. And so there's this real tension in my own life. And that's the kind of stuff that, in a way, is helpful to bring to light within, again, ideally within a group that you'd kind of read your money autobiography with, and you'd see them more than we're going to see each other. You'd see them a bit and ask how it's going in your relationship with money. But Stringfellow, so that's just one idea. The other one is New Roadmap Foundation's book, Your Money or Your Life, which really tries to get at this life is a gift, and the hours you spend in your car to get to work, the money you spend on your clothes that you need for work, all that kind of needs to be factored in to what you make per hour, for example. I mean, what are the real costs of your job, and then what is it you're actually being paid? And is that worth it to you? Is that what you want? Is that your expression of your values? So it's this way to help you think through time and money in a bit of a different way, and I think a helpful way. But just briefly, freedom from idolatry of money for a Christian means that money becomes useful as a sacrament, as a sign of the restoration of life wrought by Christ in the world. And it is seen not only in freedom from an undue affection for money, but freedom upon moral dependence upon the pursuit, acquisition, or accumulation of money for the sake of justifying oneself or one's conduct. So again, it gets back to these self-justifications that we, again, use money to justify ourselves. He says that's the moral, the moral dependence upon the pursuit, acquisition, or accumulation of money, and that, that there's freedom from that when money is used as a sacrament. And finally, it occurred that our sense of selfhood or worth within the good life, again, as Dale has helped us, possessions, positions, and abilities, this self-justifying, this is who I am. Over here, Dale has talked about it being simply, you are who you are by the grace of God. And you are a saint, is how Stringfellow would define it. And I want to read to you this awesome definition of a saint. And it's in the same, it's like the last paragraph in this chapter on the idolatry of money. He says, in truth, all human beings are called to be saints, but that just means called to be fully human, whole and mature. The saints are simply those who relish the event of life as a gift, relish the event of life as a gift, and who realize that the only way to honor such a gift is to give it away. The only way to honor such a gift is to give it away. So again, we get back to this sacred universe again, and that all of life is sacred and a gift. And the only way to honor such a gift is to offer it openly. And it seems to me that that also ties back in very closely with Jesus' invitation to the abundant life. When he talked with the rich young man, as I talked about on Monday, inviting this rich young man to give away all he had and give it to the poor, sell all he had and give it to the poor, because he recognized that for that rich young man, it was that that kept him from this sort of an attitude toward life, as opposed to this sort of, you know, clutching. And it was that that which set him free. Any comments, questions?
One little piece that we touched on briefly, and I'd like to say another word about, I guess, is it's a positive word about the culture of our time in North America, but it's been here for a long time, and that's the role of volunteerism and the voluntary association. De Tocqueville talked about it 170 years ago, how that distinguished this emerging society from Europe. And it seems to me today that's a growing phenomenon. The number of people who give the gift of their time without expecting remuneration. And it's not just Holden Village that operates because of volunteerism. It's a lot of pieces of our life together in North America that function only because of volunteerism, because of people being willing to give their time without getting a paycheck for it. And a lot of it's retired people, but it isn't just retired people who do that. And I think that's something positive that we should thank God for, that phenomenon of volunteerism, which I guess no other society on earth has in quite the same way, or to quite the same degree that we have. And it's been true for a long time, as was pointed out, for women in our culture to give time without getting a check for it in the home and in child raising and all of that. But it's a lot broader than that too today, and I just think we ought to celebrate that.
There's also
that's outside the marketplace.
Yeah, but there is a recent hubbub around that, the Harvard site, sociologist who studied volunteerism and at least our participation in groups, maybe it was more that, but that sense of community identity is declining.
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe volunteerism isn't, but that's...
No, volunteerism is also declining, and that's because of the economy. Many people can find a job now instead of for pay.
A paid job, yeah. Uh-huh.
Did,
I just wanted to say, just on, like, as far as celebration is concerned, I mean, I celebrate the fact that we're in a culture where we can ask ourselves these questions. This is sort of a new thing that's happened the last 50 or 100 years. I mean, life has become so abundant that we're not struggling to survive.
Yeah.
Now we can ask ourselves questions that society couldn't ask ourselves 100 years ago. We were just trying to live.
Yeah.
You know. So I mean, there's some sunshine to picture the excess that we've been graced with for our ability to sustain life.
But there's an interesting twist on that. I've been thinking about relative between money and wealth. And I think you were talking Tuesday maybe about somehow the feedback system, information system has been disrupted in the world of economics about what's sensible or not.
Getting prices right?
Yeah. Living in an agricultural community has taught us something different about abundance, and that is that abundance has a price. At harvest time, when we harvest apples, you got a couple problems. One is they take up space. Two, they weigh, you know, they rot. You know, so you have this abundance of fruit. It's not money, it's abundance of fruit. People who are abundant to something natural share, because in a way there's a certain burden to having abundance. What are you going to do with all this? And anybody who's got a garden and grows zucchinis understands that. What are you going to do with this stuff?
Give it away.
And you do, you give it away.
Yeah.
You share. And money is the only commodity, if you will, that has no price for accumulation. And so, in my looking at this, if I had to tithe zucchinis, it would be a whole lot easier than tithing my money. Because the more money, there's never any cap on accumulating money, so you're always in a position of scarcity. And I think that's got something to do with the feedback system that happens in our global economy. And I forget what you said that made me think about that, but.
In fact, there's a benefit to accumulating money. I mean, it makes more money. I mean, there's not only is there not a cap on it or.
Yeah.
So there's a reward within our system. And we'll go here and then Dale, and I think we need to
just a couple
go to dinner.
One of which is we live in the San Juan Islands, and so everybody has to park in Fairyland. If you leave your window open, you're in danger because you're going to get a zucchini in it. The other thing is it's been an interesting week for me because I've been here with my six children who are all now adults. And 40 years ago, I remember sitting in the same room talking about the same subject for those of us who were in a situation of young parents with lots of little children, not enough time, not enough money at that point, and struggling with the gifts. And at that point, we called it The Gifts and The Gifts of Grace by Mary Schramm. It's probably one of the most significant books that I think has been written and told and pressed will be putting out again. But now I see my children here this week dealing with these same issues. So those of us who have gone through some of this, who have maybe a little more time, maybe we can help in that way of giving any wisdoms that we have gotten through that time to them, because it repeats itself over and over and over.
Yeah.
Interesting week.
Dale?
Can we jump from those who are enslaved to getting, as most of us are in one way or another, to saying the answer is to give. The problem is that the enslavement to getting is out of our emptiness. And if we jump to giving from that state, giving sounds like heavy sacrifice, you know, pain, so forth. So the answer is really that if you're enslaved to getting, that you're not letting yourself receive enough from God. So the transition is to go back and say, what am I not receiving and getting from God to be filled so that I'm ready to give? And I'm concerned sometimes our churches kind of hammer on, you've got to give, you've got to give, but often don't help people see that transition.
Thank you. Well, it's time for dinner. Thanks for coming.